The Food and Drug Administration is advising drug companies to test some pharmaceutical ingredients for melamine, an industrial chemical that can lead to kidney failure and death if ingested by people. Melamine is a man-made chemical found in resins, cleaning products, fertilizers, pesticides, and other products. It can be deadly if ingested in sufficiently high amounts. In the fall of 2008, a massive outbreak of infant formula contaminated with melamine in China sickened about 50,000 infants, caused nearly 300,000 children to develop kidney problems or other urinary complications, and was blamed for at least six deaths of babies who suffered kidney failure. Three officials from the Chinese food company that made the contaminated infant formula were sentenced to death or life in prison for their parts in the scandal. In a moment, our special guest for the next 2 hours, Dr. John Abramson, Overdosed America, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. John Abramson has a lot to say about the drug companies that are systematically, he believes, misinforming you, your doctors, about the best medical care. The really scary part of this is that Dr. Abramson is not an uninformed outsider. He's a disciplined researcher, clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School. He says the American people are not just taken advantage of financially by the healthcare system, and at the same time, their health is being sacrificed to increase corporate profits. Dr. Abramson also serves as an expert for plaintiffs' attorneys in litigation involving the pharmaceutical industry. John, I bet they just don't like you, do they?
Not usually, but, you know, I think if the healthcare system is going to work, George, and if the marketplace in modern capitalism is going to work, there's got to be checks and balances. People got to tell the truth, and when people buy healthcare, they got to buy it on the right information.
Absolutely. Hey, let's get your reaction to the healthcare measure that they're kicking around now, and how Big Pharma, I think, John, this is my interpretation, you tell me if I'm right, seems to be inching its way into this bill.
I think footing their way into the bill, not inching their way into the bill. The headline in the New York Times yesterday was, although President Obama has said he wants Congress to work out the details of the health care reform bill, President Obama himself made an agreement with pharma that that pharma would not have to negotiate prices for the drugs that the federal government pays for, which is a huge price support for them.
It's massive. But during his campaign, wasn't he talking about getting tough with Big Pharma?
He was talking somewhat about getting tough with Big Pharma, George, but he really didn't walk too much into that trap. And the reason is that the pharmaceutical industry is enormously powerful in the United States.
True.
They're powerful enough to sink any politician. And I think President Obama would be a fool to try and take them head on in his first term. But what that happens then is that we're talking about major health reform in our country, but we're not talking about the elephant in the room, which is we're paying too much for drugs and for other health care that are no more effective than care that is much less expensive. And now we're making a side deal with pharma so that that expenditure, unnecessary expenditure for drugs that are more expensive but no more effective, gets locked in. And the American people get locked in to paying this excessive amount of money for care that's no better.
And let me ask you this, John. You know, when you look at so many people losing their jobs, it's going to get up to 10%. Of unemployment, which is just huge. A lot of people who can't pay COBRA, right? They leave their companies, they're allowed to keep their insurance, but they got to pay for it. So they can't. They let it lapse. They lose their insurance. It's nice to think that there's going to be universal coverage for people, but there's got to be a downside here somewhere. What is it?
The downside is that as more people become covered, George, what's going to happen is that there will be more money flowing into the healthcare industry, but that must be paid for. And if people who lose their jobs and go on COBRA lose their COBRA after a year and a half, if they require federal subsidies to buy healthcare coverage that's grossly inflated in cost above what it should be, then it's almost like we're eating our tail, that we're going to run out of money.
Right.
We can't afford to pay excessive costs for inefficient health care. And the dirty secret in all this, George, is even though we're spending twice as much as the other industrialized countries per person on health care, Americans have by far the worst health. So it's not like we're paying all this money and we're getting the best product in the world. We're paying all this money and we're getting the most expensive health care, but we're not getting the best health.
And also, John, do they really want people to live long? I mean, I keep looking at what science is trying to do, or at least the perception, and that is to increase longevity. Yet, you look at Social Security and the problems it's going to have in the future and everything else, and then population. You know, they're already talking about wanting to reduce the world's population. Do they really want to prolong the lives of people?
Well, a good question. And I think the answer is that sometimes the head doesn't know what the tail is doing. And I think if there's a generalization here, it's that American medicine has been, the goals of American medicine have been turned over to market goals rather than human goals. So if there's a generalization, George, I would say that they would be the venture capital people and the investors and the major corporations. And what they want to do, in fact, what their moral and fiduciary obligation is to do, is to extract as much money as they can to make the highest profits that they can from their medical enterprise. And whether people live longer or not is really beside the point. It's whether they make more money or not.
Well, there's no doubt Congress is going to pass some kind of health care reform bill, and it'll become law. The big question is, as you say, who's going to pay? And this is going to be a disaster when they really have to start reaching into the pockets of middle America.
That's true, and there are other big questions. Who's going to pay? But how are we going to contain the future cost of health care when it's the drug companies and the other medical industries that are producing the knowledge that's pulling more money into the system? So we've got healthcare growing at 50% over the last 10 years and the overall economy growing at 20%, and that's a train wreck that's going to happen. And you're describing the sort of primary train wreck that we're going to hear about in the near future, which is if you cover more people, we're going to run out of money. But it's a train wreck to have so much of society's money being pulled into healthcare when that healthcare isn't buying better health. And the key here is that the American people need to understand that they are not getting value for their healthcare money, and that this round of healthcare reform is not going to solve that problem. The short-term consequence is that it's going to be pulling federal money into healthcare. It may be middle-class taxes, it may be future deficits that our children and grandchildren have to pay, but we can't keep throwing money at this problem when we know we're solving it the wrong way.
Now, what about coverage for pre-existing conditions, all right? How's that going to work?
That is a key element, and I think that will get solved in this round of healthcare reform. You raised the question of an employee who loses his or her job, and maybe they go on COBRA, which is the carry forward of the group insurance rate for a year and a half, and then maybe they lose their COBRA. Then somebody's diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Or somebody ruptures a disc in their back,
right.
or has
a heart attack or something.
Or has a heart attack, right. Then that individual or that family is trying to buy health insurance, and they're not in a group. And the insurance market works like any other business. They're trying to maximize their profits. And they say, you're crazy. We're not going to insure you if you have multiple sclerosis and your drugs are going to cost $20,000 a year. You had a heart attack. We're not going to insure you. You're going to need all sorts of medical care. That's a bad business deal. So the insurers together have created a situation where that person just plain can't get health insurance. And I think this round of health and health care reform, I think, will solve that problem. And that's one of the good things that will come out, because if all the insurers, if the law changes so that no insurer can turn down somebody because of a pre-existing condition or can charge an inflated rate above the community average rate, then Americans will be better served, because that's truly insurance. In other words, it's not your fault if you get multiple sclerosis. And most people who have heart attacks, it's not your fault that you got a heart attack. So why should you alone pay that burden? Americans are decent people, and they believe that we should take care of each other in times of need. So let's set a rule that we're not all gambling, each one trying to fight for their own survival, and hoping that we won't get sick when we don't have insurance coverage. So let's make a rule that the insurance companies have to cover people with pre-existing conditions.
What's your take on these possibilities of forced vaccinations of people?
That's a tough question, George.
Yeah.
That's a really hard question, because you can get into situations. Let's take polio, for example. I assume you're old enough to have seen the polio epidemic.
Well, I'm 59. I was born 59. In 1950. Whatever they put in that vaccine, I got it.
You got it. But you also saw some kids get polio and end up in an iron lung.
Yeah.
You know,
but I'm not so sure the vaccine solved it. John, I'm not so sure it wouldn't have solved itself.
Possible. You can't know. And there are a lot of questions that you can't know the answer to. Right. That's possible. It's possible. Let's assume that the vaccine worked.
All right.
And I think it did work. I think the oral vaccine had risks and may have actually caused some cases of polio.
Right.
I think the shot, which we had to stand in line as third graders and get.
And screamed.
Right. The shot works. And in fact, polio has been almost eradicated from the world. And there's this thing called herd immunity. When you get enough people immunized from a terrible disease, or smallpox would be another example, when you get enough people immunized, an epidemic can't get going. In other words, if 80% of us were immune to swine flu, there would be no risk of a pandemic. And that may be inflated. I don't want to get people worried about swine flu. I'm just trying to make the point about herd immunity. So there are some diseases that are awful where the vaccines work. And you could make an argument that you need to have a compelling reason, a medical reason or a religious reason, not to get the vaccine. There are, on the other hand, conditions where it's not so compelling. And I think there was a vaccine for childhood diarrhea that was released and caused more problems than it cured. This vaccine for girls so they don't get human papillomavirus, I think it's really dubious and very expensive. And we're paying about $1,000 per young girl that we immunize when we could be providing primary care services and sexual education and learning how to protect their bodies and how to have primary care doctors and so forth. So I think it's a complex question, and I think you got to go vaccine by vaccine. But without a compelling social reason, benefit to have vaccine, I think it ought to be left up to individuals. And where you draw the line is a very complicated question.
See, I think a lot of vaccines cause autism in children.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. I'm agnostic. They might. I'm not saying they don't. And I'm not taking a stand that they
don't. Too
much
mercury in it or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it may well be. I think whether autism was caused by that or not, I think that the vaccine manufacturers should have gotten rid of the mercury sooner. That there was, I don't think there was an excuse except for expedience,
yes,
not to get the mercury out. Once there was any question about a problem, the mercury should have been gone. I don't know what autism epidemic is about, George. It's an awful thing. It's real. And why it's happening, I just don't know.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. writes that when they administered the vaccine that had the high levels of mercury in it, the rate of autism went way up, way up.
Yeah, there's a temporal association for sure. And whether it's causal or not, I don't know. I just don't know. I think it's important for me when I'm speaking in public to stay on the things that I really know about. And this one, I think it's an open question and a human tragedy. And we should move to the precautionary principle of first do no harm. And whenever there's a question that there is a toxin that is affecting children or any American's health, there ought to be a precaution to protect people.
When you wrote Overdosed America, what did you see? What caused you to write that book?
You know, it's a great question. Thank you, George. I actually was going to write a book about doctors taking care of patients. I was teaching a course at Harvard Medical School about doctor-patient relationships, and I was teaching doctors in training that it's not all about the science, that science can teach us some things about how to prevent and take care of disease, but most of our health is how we live our life. And doctors have to talk to people as human beings, and human beings it's not like taking care of a scientific object. Science looks at things from an external point of view, from a third-person point of view, objectively, and science measures things and reproduces those measurements. And human beings are conscious entities. And consciousness occurs only in the first person. It's a first-person experience. Some people call it spiritual or soulful or existential presence. And I was teaching medical students the difference between scientific truths and subjective truths so that they would know when they're sitting with a patient that treating that patient as a human being is equally as important as knowing biomedical science. And I was pretty far along into writing that book when I backed into the data on the FDA's website about Vioxx and Celebrex. And found that our most trusted medical journals, the New England Journal of Medicine, had published an article that completely misrepresented Vioxx and said it was a safer drug when, in fact, Merck and the FDA knew that it was a more dangerous drug than ordinary arthritis drugs.
Amazing. And yep. Now some of these arthritis drugs, as of a few days ago, they said could cause cancer, even death in children.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, they named three brands. We just can't win.
We can't win, and this is why we're not winning, George. And this is why I love being on your show, because we can talk honestly, and the people who listen to Coast to Coast want to hear how their interests are being misrepresented.
Absolutely.
The reason why we can't win is because at the front edge of medical science, what's happening is the drug industry and the other medical industries are paying for the research and keep that research secret the way Coke keeps the recipe for Coca-Cola.
Yep. Especially if it doesn't benefit them.
Exactly.
If the research is great and makes it look good, bam, it's right out there. The media picks it up.
It's out there, but you can't. Science is very complicated, and they still don't make the details available.
That's true.
I do a lot of work as an expert in court cases involving the pharmaceutical industry, and I get to see the confidential documents. I get to see what that science showed. Most of it I can't tell you because I've signed confidentiality agreements in order to serve as an expert. But that when that front edge of knowledge is produced for commercial purposes and controlled by the commercial entities that are going to benefit from it, you've got to be sure that the public will not get the maximum benefit, that the purpose of that for which that research is undertaken is to fulfill commercial obligations, not human obligations. And in medical science, we've got it confused because there's a presumption that medical science is first and foremost a humanitarian activity, and it's become first and foremost a commercial activity, and that's why the public isn't getting served.
John, we'll talk about why the audience at town hall meetings seem to be just going crazy over these meetings these days and what they're talking about. And also I want to get your take on healthcare reform as well. What you see as three major issues that you think are critical that must be addressed. What's your website, John Abramson?
It's overdosedamerica.com.
Book's still available, I trust?
The book's available. It's in its third edition, and it's wearing very well.
Very good. Dr. John Abramson, our special guest for the next 2 hours. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with him. When we come back, we'll continue chatting. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. Don't touch your dial. Okay, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. John Abramson, Overdosed America. More questions for him, though, when we come back. Hey, have you signed up yet for the free Coast Zone newsletter? You can do that by just going to coasttocoastam.com. It's in the upper right-hand corner. The newsletter is delivered to your computer every morning. And also, for you Streamlink members, you're now getting 1 year's worth of going back to get free programs from the past for 1 year, all the way back. We're working on 2 years now, so that could come within another 30 days or so. If you want to sign up for Streamlink, you can do that as well by going to coasttocoastam.com. What do you believe are the three major issues that the Health Care Reform Act must address?
George, it's really simple. The three issues that we've got to address in health care now and in the future are, one, how do we cover the uninsured? The United States is the richest country in the world, and we're the only industrialized country that doesn't make sure everybody's got coverage. 18,000 Americans die every year because they don't have coverage. We've got to figure out a way to get it done.
Yeah.
But it's a problem because our health care costs twice as much as health care in the other industrialized countries. So number one is covering the uninsured. Number two is we've got to contain the cost of health care. Now, it would be impossible to contain the cost of health care if our health care dollars were actually buying us better health. But number three is that Americans are not the healthiest people among the industrialized world. They're the least healthy. Americans live 2.5 years less in good health than the citizens of the other industrialized countries. So that creates an enormous opportunity, because once Americans understand that they're paying twice as much for inferior health care, yeah, bells and whistles, yeah, it may be the latest, but it's not the best care. It's not what will produce the best health outcomes. So we've got a situation where it's time to realize that the emperor is not wearing many clothes here. And though we're told we get the best health care in the world, we're not getting the best health, and we need to revise this. So there's a real opportunity to do that. Now, one of the consequences, besides being the least healthy among the citizens of the industrialized world, another consequence, which is really important, is that Americans' wages have been flat for 10 years and health care premiums have gone up 120%. So all of the productivity of American workers, all of the growth of productivity of American workers over the past 10 years has gone into paying for their health care, which in fact has not produced better health.
Not at all.
Well, not in comparison to the other countries. Everybody's getting better, but Americans are getting better slower than the citizens in the other countries, even though we're spending twice as much. It's so bad, George, that if you look at the decrease in mortality, in deaths, that can be prevented by health care between 1997-98 and 2002-2003, for that five-year period, Ireland, Norway, and Austria were the countries that had the greatest reduction in preventable mortality, 23 to 25% reduction. They spent half as much as the United States did, and the United States only had a 4% reduction, trailing all the other countries. And the people who wrote this article that was published in Health Affairs, which is our premier health policy journal, concluded that if American health care could reduce preventable mortality as much as the three top countries, spending half as much as we are, 100,000 Americans would die, 100,000 fewer Americans would die every year. 100,000 fewer Americans. You know, that's like a 9/11, 33 9/11s a year, because our health care is not able to produce the results of countries that are spending half as much as we are. Why? Because it's determined by the market values, and it's an enormously wonderful entrepreneurial opportunity, but it's not producing the health. And that's, George, that's why I think we've got all this disruption of the town hall meetings, that we're almost getting to a real discussion like you and I are having right now in the country, and the vested interests need to jam the airwaves so that that discussion won't happen and Americans won't turn to their neighbors and say, you know, we're not getting our money's worth out of this. We need to insist that our representatives and senators straighten this out so that we're not getting used by the healthcare industry anymore. That's the discussion that needs to go on. And I think we're getting close enough so that we're seeing near brown shirt tactics to disrupt that conversation from going on and being covered by the media.
Some of these people are so upset in these meetings, John. It's unbelievable.
And you wonder why, you know, where is that coming from? How is it getting fanned? Let me give you an example of the misrepresentation that's going on. I was a family doctor for 20 years in a small town about an hour north of Boston. I made house calls, I saw newborns, and I helped people die gracefully. I tried to. I did it all. And one of the most important things that I would do as a family doctor was to have serious discussions with older folks and ask them what they wanted me to do if they got too sick to tell me what they wanted. If they wanted everything to be done, if they wanted to have a ventilator until they're absolutely stopped breathing and their heart stopped and their brain stopped, that was fine with me. And if they said, you know, I'm old and I've lived a good life, and if I get very sick and you bring me back, I won't be able to live independently, and that won't be worthwhile. If I get that sick, if my heart stops, if I stop breathing, let me go gracefully. Don't do CPR. Don't shock me. Don't put me on a ventilator. Everybody's got a different opinion. And it's so important. One of the only things that I would speed to the emergency room for in the middle of the night was to get there to protect an older patient who I knew didn't want a full court press from ending up on a ventilator and being stuck in the ICU instead of making their journey to the great beyond peacefully. That was an emergency. Now, that's President Obama's plan is to has proposed to reimburse physicians for having that discussion with their patients once every 5 years. Nothing controversial about it at all. Just to have that discussion with their patients. Whatever their patient want is what they get, but let's just find out what they want so we can serve the patient's interests when the patient can't speak for him or herself. That gets turned into rationing and killing granny and telling people that they won't get care at the end of life. And it's so distorted and is so frightening for people that there's no way they can know the truth, which is what a sin it is to be beating on somebody and putting them on a respirator and keeping them in the ICU when they're just going to die anyway. So that's an example, George, of how difficult it is right now to have a real conversation about what Americans want for their health care. And that's what scares me so much about this disruption of town meetings.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's got to get better, or who knows what direction we're going to end up, John.
They're just going to keep spending more money on bad health care. And I think as the situation gets closer and closer to being exposed, George, as Americans get closer and closer to realizing that they're being manipulated into believing that all this expensive health care is the right way to go, there's going to be more of this kind of disruption. So I think what we're seeing with the town meetings is a symptom of a system that's starting to come apart at the seams, just beginning to come apart at the seams.
If you could fix anything right now in this entire arena, what would it be?
There are two things. That's a great question. There are two things I would fix. Number one is I would make sure that medical knowledge is an accurate representation of what the research really showed. So that if there's misrepresentation of commercially sponsored research in order to sell more product, in order to convince doctors, in order to publish articles in medical journals that mislead doctors about the benefits of new drugs and procedures, I would make that a criminal offense. The same way it's a criminal offense to file inaccurate accounting reports. So that I think the core problem here is that medical knowledge is being distorted for commercial benefit. And the only penalty that the executives of the healthcare industry pay is that they get fined or they have to pay some of the money back in fines to the Department of Justice. And we can talk about those fines. But in essence, healthcare industry executives are like hedge fund operators. When they win big. When they lose, i.e. get caught misrepresenting science, they don't really lose anything. So they're playing with house money. I think we've got to ensure the accuracy of medical science and the accuracy of the information that's published in medical journals, the accuracy that of the information that doctors get at continuing medical education events that drug reps bring to them. It must be accurate. Science works if it's done well and if the results are presented honestly. And right now we've got infomercial, not science. It's got to be cleaned up. That's number one. Number two is that we Americans have to accept responsibility for preserving our own health. We've been sold a bill of goods, and we've accepted it. And we need to accept responsibility for being seduced by this. We've accepted the myth that we can do whatever we want. We can eat bad food. We can smoke. We can not exercise. We can keep our stressful ways. We can drink too much. And the doctor and a pill will bring us out of it. Well, the truth is a doctor and a pill won't bring us out of it. That 70% of our health is determined by how we live our lives. And only we can make those decisions about whether we're going to do healthy things or not. And the medical industry spends a lot of money convincing us. If you look at those cholesterol ads, you can see people eating strawberry shortcake and eating things that would drive up the cholesterol. And the implicit message is, don't worry, you can take a pill and bring it down. Well, that's not true. If the pill worked, maybe you'd want to pay for the pill. But the truth is that eating a healthy diet is much more important than what your cholesterol level is. And in fact, switching to a healthy diet may not lower your cholesterol. It will lower your risk of heart disease. But doctors and the public have all been convinced to focus on cholesterol, and it's like we're watching a great magic show and we've all got our eyes trained on cholesterol rather than the risk of heart disease.
I've got to ask you about the Michael Jackson case.
Yep.
Regardless of what happened to him, why didn't somebody say no?
I know what every other citizen knows who watches TV some, and it seems to me that this is not professional level. This is personal opinion. It seems to me that what was going on was Michael Jackson had become dependent on narcotics. And he was involved in a very lucrative concert tour. And the short-term goal was to keep him from having to go through withdrawal or overdosing, i.e. provide him with narcotics so that he could perform on the concert tour. And it wasn't done skillfully.
No, not at all.
But that's a personal opinion. I don't know that that's true. What do you think?
I agree with you. I agree with you. And they pushed him. Except I think he was probably on it longer than we think.
Yes. Yes.
Way back. You know, they say it was, when he got his hair burned and his scalp burned during that Pepsi commercial, but I think it went back even further. But, who am I to say?
Yep. Narcotics are dangerous because they do make you feel good in the short run.
What is it, though, about successful people who seem to diet in extremely young ages, the John Belushis, the Marilyn Monroes, all these people.
Yeah, Elvis Presley.
What happens to them?
Harry Garcia.
Yeah, what, John Candy, all these people, what happens to them?
You know, I think that the drug is when you get that famous, that we as human beings aren't made to be able to sustain that. And it's like Icarus flying so high that his wings melted because of the strength of the sun.
Yeah. He got too close.
He got too close. And I think that people lose their way when they get that famous and that revered. They lose their way that hard work and creativity and struggling every day is what makes a meaningful life. And then it takes the drugs to sustain that euphoric sense of well-being. I mean, I have no idea. I speak to rooms that have maybe 500 people in them, and it's not unusual that I get a standing ovation. That's a pretty great rush.
But you look at people like Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie. They don't look like that. They're into any problems like that. They seem to be able to control themselves.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I think there's a higher risk when you get a taste of that public adulation of losing your way.
Incredible. Sad.
It's sad. I mean, we've lost so many wonderfully talented people. You listen to Elvis Presley sing, you know, and I work often in my office alone, and I play music, and you listen to him sing, and you just want to cry. It's so beautiful, you know, that he was, you know, he's really like, it's the voice of the gods, and that he lost his way and perished. What a sad thing.
Yet what happens to America, John? The not famous, they're going through the same thing, aren't they?
We are, and I think we're all in the struggle to find meaning, to live a life of integrity and meaning. And when the external structure isn't supportive of that, when financial derivatives are costing good American people, the collapse of the derivatives are costing good American people their homes, and their kids aren't having the opportunity that they wanted them to have, when healthcare is costing twice as much or a third again as much as it should, and we're wasting $800 billion of our national resources on healthcare that's unnecessary or harmful, and it's draining away the profitability that should be returned to American workers so that they can live a better lifestyle, so that they can provide things to their kids that they didn't have. It makes it really hard, George, and I think that the job of democracy is to constantly have people understanding what their social circumstances are and putting pressure on politicians not to give in to the vested interests, to the best-paid lobbyists, but to represent the good, decent Americans who are working hard for their future and their family's future.
And, you know, most people, if not all people, all they want is, you know, to be happy and to be healthy, to their loved ones to be happy and healthy, and that's it.
And to work hard and get paid a fair wage.
Yeah, well, that helps, I think, in being happy and healthy.
Yes.
I think if you're working and you know, you're contributing, I think you're generally going to be a healthier person, don't you?
I there's no question about it that that's part of health. And yet what we see, I mean, where we started this conversation about health care, what we see is people are trying to do that. And I agree with you. That's what a good life is about. People are trying to do that, but as they get taken advantage of by these external corporations and
the greed factor.
The greed factor. When the greed factor gets into politics.
There's your next book.
It is my.
Take the title. It's yours.
It is.
The greed factor.
The greed factor. I'm writing it down. But when the greed factor gets into politics, so that our government isn't fundamentally focused on supporting, helping Americans to live decent lives that not economically supporting, not creating dependency, but allowing people to be responsible for themselves and their families and to be rewarded and have a meaningful life. When our government gets distracted by the lobbyists and the money in politics and the corporations that treat us like objects instead of subjective human beings, that's where we get into trouble. And I think that's what we're seeing erupt in this healthcare debate now, George.
All right. When we come back at the top of the hour, John, we're going to take a full hour of phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM.